Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Hello, happy weekend to you and welcome to the podcast. You're welcome wherever you are. We have a selection of the best conversations of the week as a warm ear hug for you as you enjoy the Euros, Bloomsday, Taste of Dublin, whatever you're into this weekend. And on this week's episodes, we have Adam and Paul, nostalgic vibes, the struggle of becoming a GP in Ireland, and the creator of Father Ted playing pickleball. First up in the podcast, you're going to hear brilliant actor-writer Mark O'Halloran, who came into us to mark 20 years since that eviscerating bleak comedy film about the state of Dublin in 2004, Adam and Paul. People still shout quotes from the film at him on the street. And he also spoke to us about his latest work, Mary and George, which stars Julianne Moore, and how on the set she told him she actually had a dream about him. So very interesting stuff. Then after that, a bit of a serious swear, because we meet Dr. Moira Trasanikalig. She's a young woman, a young mother who's a range of careers. She went through them all, but she ultimately wanted to become a GP, and she spent over €80,000 on the study and the courses, but she couldn't even begin her hospital stint as a trainee GP, which must be 2 years long, because of the inflexibility of the health system in Ireland, especially after she had a baby. And we had loads of reaction to this conversation from other young mothers in a similar boat and from others who are fleeing to Australia because of conditions in the health system here. And we will come back to that, no doubt. But it's a very interesting chat with Moira Trasa there. And to end, something more joyful for you. Our visiting critic this week was Arthur Matthews, the genius of absurd comedy from Father Ted to Brass Eye, Big Train, Toast of London, loads of satire as well. He reviewed Pickleball for us, that American phenomenon that's a bit of tennis, ping pong, badminton. And he also watched the 6-1 News, because he hasn't watched television news in a very long time. And he also told us all about his amazing new book on Kevin O'Higgins, the War of Independence hero who became the Civil War villain, and he remains a hate figure to this very day. So that is everything in the podcast. Listen through to the end, please, and subscribe to the show on Spotify. Stay with us on the wireless as well. Don't forget, RT Radio 1, 9 o'clock till 10, Monday to Friday, all the time. That's everything. So into the podcast we go.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Marie's already on to us there in 51551. Adam and Paula, very sad but brilliant movie. That's very true. I watched it again yesterday. But I'm joined in the studio by actor and writer Mark O'Halloran. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Mark, the iconic Irish movie Adam and Paul. We're celebrating 20 years. I can't believe it's been 20 years since
the release. It seems like sometimes it feels like just yesterday that it was made. And then it is also a lifetime ago. You know, it is, yeah. You know, we lost Tom Murphy straight afterwards, you know, a couple of years afterwards. So he's dead a long time. And, you know, he was very young. Like, he pretended to be much younger than he was, of course, but he was 39 when he passed away. But that now feels like just another world. But it's strange. The film still lives in lots of ways. Like I think I was just saying to you that, you know, I live in the city centre. And there's still young fellas in the local spar shop who go, "Oh my God, it's Adam and Paul."
That's incredible, isn't it?
It's so weird. And I do you know, to be recognised after 20 years for something that you made, yeah, it's lovely. It's really beautiful.
Also to look like you did 20 years ago.
Well, that's the thing.
It's the good actor's
hair. But also, no, it has to be said that I'm playing somebody who's addicted to heroin, who lives on the street in a very difficult life. So I must look absolutely wrecked,
yeah,
all the time.
Older than, yeah. So it's going to be shown as part of the upcoming Bloomsday Film Festival. We'll talk about that. And there's another short story film as well, An Encounter. But making the film and the idea that was in your head when you're writing it, I mean, what did you want to say? It was about, it's really such a Dublin film.
Yeah.
And you're a Clare man.
I'm a Clare man. But I moved to Dublin when I was about 20. Mm. And I was amazed that you could see heroin addicts on the street. Like I thought, I was living up in Parnell Street in the city centre. And I thought that was really bizarre. Like I saw a thing where I saw a young fella falling over in slow motion in the traffic island on O'Connell Street with a cigarette in one between fingers of one hand and the tip of a hypodermic needle in the
thing.
And he fell over in really in slow motion. It took him about 2 minutes to fall to the ground, and I was like, this is bizarre. And it felt like as if there was a slow motion, there was all these boys and girls walking around in a kind of a slow motion, and then everyone else was, you know, rapidly going about their business. And they didn't see them. And I was like, I was amazed. So I used to keep these diaries of things. And I remember at one point, I remember looking out my window. And at the time, Irish films, there was lots of Irish films that were about the national question. So it was all about like what the Brits did to us was desperate. And I was kind of going like, well, you know, I'm on the dole. I'm trying to make myself a career in acting. I don't care what the Brits did. Well, you know.
I care about today.
I do care about today. And I looked out the window and I was going like, why doesn't somebody make a film like that? Like The Street that I look out onto, which felt very alive and very vibrant and had lots of stories in it. And so that's kind of the germ of it. Yeah. And then I was lucky enough to get put together with Lenny Abrahamson, who is the very brilliant Lenny Abrahamson. Yeah. And the two of us, he had never made a feature film. I had never written. I mean, I remember himself and his producer, Johnny Spears. You know, I brought in these sample scenes and my idea for what Adam and Paul would be. And then they said, all right, we're going to commission you to write a script. And I remember leaving that day going like, I'm absolutely crazy. I don't know how to do this.
You've got to
I have
do it
no
now,
idea.
So the diaries had to come out.
The diaries have to come out. And I began to, I remember the first, I sat at my desk and I was going like, how do you write, how do you start a film? So I just started with my character glued to a mattress, you know, like I had no idea what I was doing. Absolutely no idea.
Which sets a very funny tone at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's a delicate line, isn't it?
Well, it is a delicate line because you don't want to be making fun of people. But I believe that everybody's ridiculous. We're all absolutely ridiculous, stupid people, all of us. And so, you know, I believe we should laugh at ourselves. We should laugh at everybody else. But we should also care for people. So there was an idea of giving a dignity to people who were nameless in lots of ways. And there was a joke in the middle of it, like it's called Adam Paul, but you never find out which one is Adam, which one is Paul.
And I'm sure you're Adam.
Well, now it says it in the credits.
Oh, does it? Okay.
But we laughed at the time because people would look at the credits and go like, who the hell is Mark O'Halloran and who the hell is Tom Murphy? Anyway, nobody knew who we were. So they wouldn't be able to figure out. And it was a kind of a joke about I liked the idea of people leaving the film and struggling to name people that they would normally step over on the street. So that was it in its basic sense. Yeah. But I used to deliver these pages of dialogue that I'd written over to Lenny Abrahamson's house, and we'd sit around his kitchen table and we'd laugh or we'd have ideas about things, and then I'd go away and write more pages, and it all came together, and within a year we were making it, which was kind of bizarre. Like, you know, I wasn't in the film industry, you know what I mean?
Was it shot very quickly?
It was shot over a month. It was shot in November 2003, I suppose. Yeah. It was miraculous because it was a very bright month.
Yeah, but it's was a lot of sunshine, but it's
absolutely freezing. So at the end, when a certain thing happens to my character, I have to lie on a beach for quite a long time.
And you can see the wind.
It was so cold. I took me about a month to get over the cold of that, of lying down. But it was also a very vibrant time. Making it it was just one of those happy accidents that happen in life where you find yourself doing something really vital that you really love and that you really believe in. Because it doesn't always happen that you believe in something or that you have that same energy. And you know, we'd never talked, or, you know, Lenny and I had never talked about, like, what about the box office figures, or who are we going to show this film to? Or we had no sales agent, we had nothing. And it just kind of, it resonated with people when it came out in a kind of a way. And it had this amazing journey around the world, you know.
How did it do, can you remind us? Because it is 20 years.
Well, we did really surprisingly well at the box office in Ireland, but also within about a couple of weeks, I remember I met this young fella on Parnell Street, and he goes, oh, look, wait, I'll show you. And he took out a DVD that had the name Adam across it, and it had been ripped off. So it was ripped off an awful lot.
It was already been pirated.
It was pirated. And I was kind of delighted with that. I was kind of going, well, you know, I don't mind as long as people get to see it. And people still watch it. I'm really, and people come up to me all the time, as I said, you know, and shout at me on the street, I'm not wiping myself with a potato bag. and all of that.
And that is a perfect example of the delicate balance between something that was so incredibly grim, but there was a wee bit of humour there.
Yeah, well, like, we wanted to show like how difficult it was to live on the street and all of that. That idea that, you know, where do you go to the toilet? Yeah. Where do you find food? Where do you
constantly being moved on
and being hated and being spat on, basically, and all of those things. How do you deal with that and maintain a dignity within yourself? And there was a joke within it where Tom's character is afraid of the electric toilet on O'Connell Bridge, so he has to go and have a shite behind a dumpster, and then he doesn't have anything to wipe his arse with, and find a tato bag in which to do it. I mean, the corporate logo or whatever of tato must have been absolutely horrified. Yeah, yeah.
Like, I noticed actually quite a few logos appearing in the...
there were more innocent times.
They were, yes.
They weren't so vetted. But yeah, it was trying to... That idea of trying to find dignity and the ridiculousness of it all at the same time.
Well, you give us sympathy, or you get the audience to be sympathetic towards Adam and Paul, mm-hmm. but also see how brutal they can be in their search for drugs.
Yeah.
And that heartbreaking scene down the alleyway with the kid they lure from the bus stop who has Down syndrome.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that there's a shot of them when they're bringing him down the thing, and they both hold his hand, and it was like I had been really obsessed with the Jamie Bulger case and the video of those two boys taking another boy away, and it was that kind of thing was in there, because it's a horrible thing that they do. And and part of it was that scene was probably the last scene that I wrote, and it was because we maybe had been too soft focus on them.
Yes.
And we needed to show, these people are also capable of doing, as all of us are, of doing the worst.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to show that as well. And so that was, you know, it was a risk to put scenes like that in, you know, it was. But I think it was worth doing, you know.
And I think the way the camera holds on the kid crying in the alleyway, that kind of close. It's nearly a Lenny Abrahamson trademark at this stage.
Well, so it was there from the brilliance of Lenny Abrahamson. I mean, yeah. I was so lucky. And also the brilliance of Tom Murphy. I have to talk about Tom Murphy.
Of course, yeah.
You know, I wrote the part specially for Tom Murphy. And Tom and I had been going out for 8 years, and we had split up as I was writing it. So you may notice in the film, like, he gets knocked down by a moped, he gets a football in the face.
That was
an ex-boyfriend's revenge, basically. I used to ring him up and go, Tom, I got you knocked over by a moped today, and all of that. So there was a bit of fun. But he arrived on set. Tom was the most extraordinary actor. Like, he had a type of acting that I sort of describe as being egoless. Like, it wasn't drawing attention to itself because I'm brilliant. Mm. It was just because he was the character. And he was that character. He arrived to us on the first day, like, and he just looked a mess.
Ready-made.
And he was a posh kid, really, you know. There's a scene in it where everybody's in the park and he gets the football in the face, and then he unzips his jacket and he goes, I'm sweating. And it still makes me laugh. It's just so funny. And I remember we took the film to the Berlin Film Festival, and there was some press wanted to interview people, and Tom was just so shy. He didn't want anything to do with that. He went to the premiere, and then he disappeared that evening. It was like, no, I don't.
There was no ego.
He was just too shy, and he was a lovely, lovely man.
Frank from Newcastle West has texted saying Tom Murphy was a wonderful actor whose star shone brightly for those like me who were fortunate enough to see him on the stage during his all too brief career. What happened to him?
He got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma,
yeah.
And he was diagnosed and dead, I suppose, within 6 months. It was very, very quick. Yeah,
he didn't make it to 40. I think he was 39, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I used to joke with him that he would do anything not to get to 40, but in a dark way. But yeah, it was a shock for all of us, and also it was as I get older, and like, I miss him every day. I think about him every day. As I get older and I move farther away, I think of all the work that he would have done, because I think he would have done like world. I think the performance in Adam Paul is one of the greatest Irish performances.
Yeah. Both of you, yeah. It's incredible.
I wouldn't put myself in the same league as him, actually. I think don't even take my word for it.
There was loads of the film reviews all said.
They were very nice to us.
The whole movie is carried by these two amazing performances. Particularly, well, you know, British film critics in particular.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they look down their nose at Irish films.
They do
in
a
that
bit.
Era in particular.
They do a bit. And it was when I arrived on set and Tom was so kind of there, I was like, oh my God, I better up my game here. And he upped all our games. And actually, it was a weird confluence because Lenny was also brilliant. So he upped the game. And I think I brought a good script to them. So that upped the game around. We kind of upped each other's games, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
No, it does. Actually, I'm going to play a clip here. It's a long enough one, but it's they're coming into the flat and the door is slightly ajar. And they start to wonder what they can do in the flat, and it doesn't take them long to figure out.
God, that telly's nice.
Big.
It is?
Yeah.
It's a good picture, isn't it?
Clear.
It's like looking out a window, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Except it's cartoons.
Yeah. The old place is spotless too.
Lovely.
Yeah, crazy.
What?
Spending all your money on your flat.
Do you think?
Yeah. Only gets robbed in the end.
I suppose.
Definitely. So that telly's worth money.
For you, Bob.
Ask him. A bit heavy though.
No way.
Do you think?
Yeah. Lift it with me. Come on. See?
Yeah, it's right, love.
Yeah, easy still.
Yeah, easy. Just ask him to be robbed, so.
Ask.
Ask him.
I just love the idea that They convince themselves that the television itself has asked to be robbed.
Yeah.
That they can't take the... Because they are going in to steal the television from their girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. And who has her life together.
Who has her life together. But they can't accept responsibility. So they find a way of not accepting responsibility by blaming the television.
There's loads more. Lots of reaction coming in, actually. And we'll come to that in a second because there's so much about the movie. It's 20 years old that resonates today. So we'll have a chat about it. Mark Holland will stay with us. We're going to take a quick break.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
Five 51551 is on the text. This one says, Mark O'Halloran, he's a brilliant writer and the film Adam and Paul could be set today. We landed back from holiday yesterday. Crossing O'Connell Street was doomsday. Bleak. And congratulations on the 20 years, Mark.
Thanking you.
It is quite similar because there is homelessness, poverty, addiction. There's even xenophobia because they sit next to a bench and he's from Bulgaria.
He's from Bulgaria.
Which was the obsession with Eastern Europe we had at the time.
Yes.
We had a whole referendum to strip birthrights from people in the middle of the boom. That commentary that you're talking about Dublin then, does that feel like the Dublin you know today? Because you live in around Dublin 8 somewhere.
I live in Dublin 8. Yeah, I mean, Dublin hasn't changed that much. You know, there's a lot of change, a lot of building and all of that. There's a demographic change, which I think is fantastic. But the streets feel the same, you know, and O'Connell Street.
Are they safe?
I mean, I walk the city all the time, so yeah. I have never encountered, you know, but you know, you have to be careful in any city you go around. Yeah. You know, if you see some yahoos around, you cross the street, that kind of thing. But I love the city. I absolutely love Dublin. I still love Dublin. I'm not ever going to move from Dublin. I find there's a vibrancy here. There is a kindness here as well as a kind of a difficulties and all of that goes on with every major city. But there is a genuine kindness that I like. There's an ability to speak to people. You know, people talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. And
you don't feel that elsewhere?
I don't feel it elsewhere. You know, I lived in London a lot last year and I love London and it's great, but it doesn't have that same connection thing.
It's very severe, isn't it?
It can be, yeah. It can be. I mean, I was living up in Stoke Newington, so it's really left field, you know, so it's kind of like everyone's having their, I don't know, their tofu and their this, that and the other. But it's still... when I got back to Dublin, I was like, oh, this is great. I'm back. I love it. And I love walking the city. I walk the city every single day. Like I walk. And O'Connell Street,
It's no. People seem to be surprised by O'Connell Street. O'Connell Street's been like this like for 30, 40 years. Like it's always been like this.
Nearly everyone's living memory.
And it's kind of hilarious when you go up there. Like it's a fantastically beautiful street, but it's full of dereliction. There's a big massive hole up at the top of it that they haven't ever filled and put down anything with. And everyone's surprised. But it also has like it's a very interesting street to walk around if you're a writer or if you're into listening to stories or seeing people. It's a great place.
You see the world slightly differently, I think.
Maybe. Well, I'm always looking for stories, you know, that's how I make my living. So like,
and is it because you're looking at it at the sort of character level of individuals rather than taking the broad look and saying this place is filthy, probably full of crime, it's dangerous, there was a riot here, I don't like it?
Well, the day after the riot, I went into the city centre, and I was in the city centre when I felt that there was things kicking off, and I went back to my flat. And then the next morning I went in very early into O'Connell Street to see it, because that is now part of our history, and I wanted to feel what it was like on the street and the temperature of all of that, and to hear stories and to talk to people. And it was that particular incident was particularly shocking and all of that.
Yeah.
And I think it shocked a lot of people.
But the city came back to itself.
It did, yeah.
Quickly,
it did.
Didn't it?
Yeah, like that evening I remember, you know, I got a lot of text messages from people of colour maybe that I know that are friends of mine who are frightened and everything like that. And I think a lot of people like me did get messages like that, and they were suddenly, I think everybody was suddenly then angry. Like, no, you don't do that.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
It was also just such a visceral example of the racism that we'd been talking about. Just sort of shot to the... it was such a visual experience around the world, showing this is not really the Ireland of 100,000 welcomes after all.
Yes, that was that. That's the 100,000 welcomes without the window. But I do still believe that it's a welcoming country. I do believe that we are... I mean, I love the way that we're able to speak to each other and speak like in cafes to complete strangers, or speaking to your local taxi driver or any of that. I just love all of that.
Yeah. Well, you can't on one hand say we have too many people now in the country. We'll pause immigration, and then also cheer on, you know, the likes of Rashida Adeleke, born and bred in Tala.
Fabulous.
The new Irish.
Fabulous.
Do you lose your right to cheer on those Irish athletes?
Look, there will always be naysayers and cranks and all of that, and that's there. But I think that the solid middle ground, or more than the middle ground, the vast majority of Irish people are decent, and that's why I live here. Because, you know, I could have moved away.
I should chat to you more often. You're very optimistic.
I despair.
I think the West of Ireland would have...
But, you know, I think I do believe that, you know. Yeah. And
you do. I can hear it. Yeah. You still have the lovely soft West of Ireland lilt, by the way.
You know, it changes every so often.
It certainly
when
does.
I'm on the phone to my mother, it's much heavier. That's all I know. Hello, how are you, man?
Pure Claire. Great to hear Mark on the radio. He was brilliant recently. Mary and George playing Francis Bacon. Sir Francis Bacon.
Sir Francis Bacon.
Did you enjoy the experience of historical drama? Says this. This is more raunchy... period drama on television.
No, I didn't get my raunch on, as they'd say. They didn't want to see me with my raunch on. Getting into work every day. First of all, you're working with Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galstein and all of those lovely, fantastic people, Tony Curran. And they give you ruffs and pantaloons and tights.
It's like a long ordeal.
Like this is, it's a long way from Adam and Paul when you're tying the ribbons on your shoes. But it was absolutely joyous. And I, especially working with Julianne Moore, it was like, this was just this mad, mad dream.
Did you get chatting to her?
I chatted to her quite a bit. She came in to me one day and she said, Mark O'Halloran, I had a dream about you last night. And I absolutely nearly fell off the chair and died. And I said to her, Julianne, you can't say things like that to an elderly homosexual like me. It's too much. It's too much. But she was great fun. And she made, you know, because she's a really, 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 really big star, and she can set the tone on a set.
Is that right?
But she's very kind and open, and there's fun and frolics going on before she goes. And then she's really serious about her work.
Oh, wait,
and I thought I had a brilliant 6 months filming that.
There's the headstone sorted now, Mark. Julianne Moore once dreamt
once had a dream about him. She said I was in bed with some, platonically, with some Irish friend of hers in New York.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. That's interesting.
Isn't it interesting that she said the way the you details. Worm your no. way into yeah, celebrities' minds?
Come here, is making period drama, is that like being on set at 3 o'clock in the morning, hair, makeup, and then taking the entire day to set up a 2 minute thing?
Well, not really. This set moved quite quickly. Mm. But what was amazing was I hadn't really been on a set that had a huge budget.
Yes.
Okay. And I suddenly arrived and there was hundreds of people.
And your every need.
Stately homes and these crane shots and everything. It was just extraordinary. You could get a taste for it, which is unfortunate because they like haven't more. Run me in a while. But it's yeah, it was a great, great, great experience.
You'll do more of that. Yeah,
oh, sure. I do more yeah, of that yeah, in of the course. Morning.
The Bloomsday Film Festival, it's at various Dublin venues, 12th to the 16th of June. So that's when, and they've chosen Adam and Paul because it's the 24-hour thing, isn't it? It's
well, I think there was, first of all, there's two things. Like there's it, the film will be preceded by a half an hour short film that I wrote that Kelly Campbell made called An Encounter, which is an adaptation of the Joyce short story.
Yes.
And the Joyce short story had an impact on the making of Adam and Paul as well, as well as Ulysses, that idea of a day in the city and the walking around the city and all of that. I didn't go after the Joycean language or anything like that,
no.
But there are echoes of it in there. And but with the adaptation, It is a Joyce short story, and it is like a sister piece to Adam and Paul.
Yeah,
it's two young fellas ditching off from school.
All right,
and going on a wander in the city, and then they meet a creepy man at the end.
Well, that's right on point with school aversion, school avoidance, and all that.
Yep.
At the minute, so that's a short film, and will we able to see that then elsewhere?
Has been at festivals all over the world and has won loads of prizes. And Kelly Campbell did an absolutely fantastic job on the making of it. It's a really lovely piece, actually.
Mm. What are you going to? What are you working on at the moment?
I'm adapting lots of novels. So I'm adapting a John Boyne novel, The Heart's Invisible Furies.
Oh yes, I've heard about
for
this.
For television. Now we haven't been given the green light yet, but
okay.
We're all in living in hope. It would just take a big budget and all of that sort of thing. So
Ridley Scott was rumored to be involved at one point.
Yes,
I think
so it's not for Ridley Scott. It's for a Disney company in the United States that were writing it. So that would be great if it happened. We'll have the nation cross their fingers.
Would that be a movie or a series?
It'll be a series.
Yeah, it'd have to be because it's
And it's
an
a
epic.
Book that people really love. And, it's a joy to be working on. And then I have a couple of films that hopefully will get made, that are scripts that I've written in the next, one would go into production now, hopefully at the end of the year, and the other in maybe late spring next year.
You're very kind of calm about it. You just like to float here and there.
These things happen or they don't happen. That's the way I look at it. And all my job is just to sit at home and type. and at the moment I'm actually acting in a four-part TV show called Mixtape, which is for an Australian TV company, and Jim Sturgis is in it.
Oh, yes, I have heard about this.
Teresa Palmer. Yeah. It's really sweet and lovely.
It's a Joe Spain.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And the scripts are absolutely divine. Divine. And I play a lad from Sheffield.
Very good.
That was
my
Sheffield accent.
Yeah, good at the accent.
Well, there's an accent coach there who helps you.
Really?
So when doing Sir Francis Bacon, there was somebody there as well to teach me to do the posh English. So that was.
What was their hot tip? What's the takeaway from that?
The R's.
The R's.
So, like, for instance, I had to say one day, this is war. And I put on the R at the end. So I said, this is war. And so you suddenly sound Irish.
You drop that completely.
So you have to drop that and they'd come up to you and go.
You put an H in
could
there.
You clip? Yeah, that kind of thing.
It's war. That's the tip of the day. Loads of nice compliments coming into you.
Oh,
I have to give this to you because your ego is too small. You need to flame it up. OMG, please ask Mark to go straight into politics. He's so positive and upbeat. I love it. It's so refreshing. Great to hear positivity, says Moira in Cork. You have no interest in politics.
I have no interest in politics whatsoever.
Amazing listening to Mark. One, if not the most effortlessly handsome men in Irish theatre. Beaut.
I completely agree. I'm available for dates. That's all I'm saying.
We can't give out the number because of GDPR. What we can tell you is that the Bloomsday Film Festival runs at various Dublin places, including the IFI, I presume, which is where Mark Holler and Shirley lives half the time. from the 12th to the 16th of June, obviously.
And Adam Ball is the 16th, so...
16th, on Bloomsday itself. Yeah. Marco Halloran, it's been a pleasure. That's so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Enjoy yourself in the English accent.
Whatever. I'll do my best.
51551 is the text. More
from
break.
The North Text Studio, followed by your message to 80889. This is the Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1 podcast.
Welcome back. 51551 is our text now. Maura Trasany Callig has had a couple of different careers, all of them very interesting, but she had a dream of becoming a doctor, a GP, but it didn't quite go according to plan. She's in studio with us. Good morning to you, Maura Trasa.
Good morning.
The number of careers you had, you've had a few of them. Let's get those out of the way, first of all, to discover how you ended up on this path.
Jack of all trades, master of none, I think. I grew up in Connemara in County Galway, just over the road from TG Cahir. So back in the day, kind of, when I wasn't going to college for the first time, TG Cahir was still very brand new and glamorous, and a lot of us kind of looked at that and said, oh geez, that's kind of cool.
Makes sense, that's a place to go. Yeah,
and there's jobs, which, you know, weren't particularly fulsome in Connemara. I did a degree in Galway. I did a degree in Irish and psychology, and then I did a HDIP in applied communications, because again, TV, radio was all there on your doorstep, and at that time they really were actively hiring, and kind of fell into media. I mean, I wouldn't say I was particularly good at it, but I'm not bad at talking, so that helps. And worked in radio in the Gaeltachta first off, doing local news and then national news and that kind of thing. And then got a job in TG Cahir and worked there for a few years. And then I ended up moving up here to Dublin. Actually, I worked here in RTE for a few years as well in the newsroom. I was working for Nuachta News, and I did one stint as well as a summer of GAA reporter under Marty Morrissey.
Really?
That was a bit of crack,
And, did you love working in the media?
I did. I loved facets of it. I realised very quickly that hard news wasn't for me. I used to find it very stressful. So then I managed to manoeuvre my way into sport. And that was really where I found the draw, because that was live broadcasting, which is great fun. As I mentioned there, my original degree was psychology, and I had a draw for that, but I never really knew what I wanted to do with it. And also, the options weren't as varied then. And then I kind of realised, I love sport. I love psychology. So why not try and marry them and do sports psychology? So
you did?
Yeah, I did a master's degree while working here, actually, in sports psychology down in UL. And that's kind of what led me onto the path to medicine, because I kind of learned that there was so much I didn't know. And I began to realise I didn't know what I knew what I didn't know. And I said to myself, right, the whole mind-body axis, physical health, mental health, it all ties into one, and well-being. And well, sports psychology is really interesting. We think it only affects like the top 0.5% of the population. But then I suddenly realised there's a lot of sports psychology that, if the likes of me and you applied to our daily lives, makes life easier, better, more effective. Okay. And this is why you actually see a lot of corporate people now bringing in people who've worked in sport and sports psychology.
Because of the goals and driving
yourself
towards
exactly.
them.
And a bit of positive psychology as well. I used to be very cynical, believe it or not. Maybe it's working in news.
Perfect for news.
But I kind of learned, like, that's not good for your well-being. So I kind of proactively learned ways to make myself that little bit more optimistic. And then that kind of opens up the little door of self-belief. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, I might do a PhD in this. This is fascinating. I love the mind. And then, like, because the confidence built up, it was like, well, you know, you did think, you know, back in the day when you were in school, you were very good at school. I was very lucky. I was book smart, no street smarts, but very good at reading books and doing exams.
Yeah.
So I said, why not try the whole medicine thing? Because that's where you get the whole mind and body thing. So that's kind of what
I like
led
how
me.
At a young age, you sort of knew what you wanted to do, and you took on each stage, didn't you? So you went from news to sport to sports psychology. You identified medicine.
Or did I fall into them? I think possibly by the time I got to sports psychology stage, I kind of knew what I was at. But it took all my 20s to do the long meandering roads.
None of it wasted, though, to be fair.
No.
So you wanted to be the GP. How do you start this process? I mean, when you've got a psychology degree, we know the normal route, maybe leaving surgery into medicine. Where did you start from?
It's a different route for sure. So a few years ago, I say it's about 10, 12 years ago now, Ireland started off graduate entry medicine, which is a way for people who already have a degree, who potentially might have wanted medicine, they're leaving cert, didn't get the points, or potentially may have come back to medicine later in life like me.
Like you
can apply for that. You sit a god-awful exam called the GAMSAT exam. And I sat that GAMSAT exam in UCD. You start at 9 a.m. and you're not out till 6 that night. And if you get a specific mark, you get yourself into your choice of medical school. Plus, you have to have had a 2-1 previous degree. Now, the 2-1 previous degree could have been in painting. It doesn't matter, so long as it's a 2-1.
It has to be 2-1 at least.
And you get your specific mark in GAMSAT, and that gets you into
the entry
exam. To the accelerated 4-year medical degree. So normally some people might do medicine over 5, 6, 7 years. I went into the Royal College of Surgeons and did it in 4.
That must be an intense 4 years.
It was... You know that feeling when you're overwhelmed all the time and your heart's going 90 and you can't breathe for 4 years?
Yeah. You're not really ready. But you loved it.
It was great. I did love it. I really did love it. The whole idea of the GAMSAT exam is that's meant to show them that you've picked up a baseline of science so that you can go in at the accelerated level. So the first year was very tough. It was very, you know, chemistry, physics, biology, that kind of stuff. So that was really hard.
Intense 4 years. What happens next?
Well, first of all, you have to pass your degree. If you pass your degree, then you apply for a job. You get an intern job. You do your internship in any of the interning hospitals in Ireland. And then technically you are fully fledged technically as a doctor, but you're obviously not trained as a specialist in any specialty, and that's when you start applying to the various specialties, i.e. GP training.
So this is where you go to GP. So is that a year of
intern? That's 4 years. Internship is for one full year, and then GP training is 4 years.
Right. So you've done, at this stage you've done 5 years of it, and now you've another 4 years to go to become a GP.
Yes.
Okay, wow. And what happens in those 4 years?
In those 4 years, you've 2 years in a hospital and 2 years in various GP surgeries. So you go around specialties that could be useful.
Are there entry level exams here for that part? Are they kind of...
Yes. Okay, you apply for it. Yeah. So there's a process. You have to do an exam. And then if you get a decent enough mark in that exam, if they deem you eligible, then you go and you do an interview. And then if you pass the interview stage, then you're offered a place in the GP training.
Okay. So I didn't realise there were interviews to just... trained to become a GP.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And how many places are there then?
It's increasing every year. I'm not 100% sure this year. I think it might be like 120 spaces, and it's going up to 130, 140, 150, because as we know, we don't have enough of them in this country.
Yeah.
So you do that. So for two years...
I'm amazed, because I know there's a kind of a shortage of GPs and all of that crack. I thought just any number of GPs available, we'll train them up, but it's not. It's
no, because it's obviously very restrictive. It is very restrictive, because there are places in hospitals that you need to have these GP trainees in there, and then also you need to have GP trainers dotted around the country who will take responsibility for somebody like me while I'm learning.
Okay, so you got to do this interview?
I did.
Okay, the circumstances were interesting?
Yes, they were indeed. I had had a baby 6 days before said interview. I looked
like
a ghost.
You don't do things by halves.
No, but like you kind of get sucked into this. Oh, I have to do it. I have to do it. And so we got notification, I think in November, that I was successful in the first hurdle, which was the exam. And we're going to host interviews. And we're telling you now the interviews will be held on the 8th and 9th of the specific month.
Yes.
I remember thinking, okay, yeah, my baby's due on the 5th. And I sent them an email and I said, look, guys, just in case I don't show up, it's not that I'm not interested, it's just I might be in Holles Street.
Yeah. You know? And incredibly, you do the interview.
It was online, thankfully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still and all, it's the interview for, you know, becoming a GP.
Oh, I look like a ghost. Yeah. Like, I was very, very pale and very tired.
You get through it, but I'm just thinking, you've got a newborn baby and now you're starting this four-year regime to become a GP. And where does that begin?
Well, the doctor year, which for people not in the know, tends to start in July. That's when all the July training.
Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah, most people don't know. Why would they? Because, you know, people aren't in that circle. So that's when doctors change over in hospitals. That's when people go up a level. That's when people become brand new consultants, all that kind of stuff. And the interns start as well in July. So that was due to start in July. I wasn't able to, obviously, because of maternity leave and I had a few postpartum complications. So I was pushed forward to this July. And I asked then if I could do it part time because baby, and I also knew the hours in hospitals and stuff. You know, they're not conducive to childcare or to seeing family relatives or having a bath. You know,
any part of the family experience, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So do you, what happens?
It's moved to July and then you start in a hospital job and they put you into specialties that would be useful as your GP. So paediatric appointments, for example, obstetrics, which are handy when you're dealing with pregnant women who are coming into your surgery, geriatric medicine, emergency, that kind of thing, just to expose you more to conditions that you might see as a GP.
And it includes weekends and nights, a whole lot. And you've 4 years of this stretching out ahead.
You've 2 years of that and then you've 2 years working in GP surgeries. And you're still on call in those GP surgery years, but it's certainly not as intense as hospital medicine.
Of course, yeah. So do you start the process?
So I asked if I could start part-time and through various jigs and reels and roundabouts, I discovered no, it's not going to be facilitated.
Can't be done.
Then I asked, would it be possible to be placed in a hospital that would facilitate the childcare that I had arranged?
Yes.
Because they did have placements in various hospitals.
Oh, you don't get to choose the hospital, like
no.
it?
No.
Oh, right. Yeah. So you could be living anywhere in the country.
You could. Now, to be fair to the GP scheme, they are much more regionalised than all the other specialties. Mm-hmm. So I knew technically wherever they could put me would be within an hour of my house, which is really a gift because there's many doctors who start off in Cork and then in July are moved to Letterkenny. So for me, it was definitely going to be easier for anyone doing the GP training for that reason because they have, to be fair to them, they have regionalised it in that way. So I asked to go to one hospital where I knew I had childcare organised en route to said hospital. And I got no reply. And then I got an email last November telling me they were going to send me in a hospital the opposite direction, which would have meant my daily commute 2 hours each way.
So 4 hours in the car.
Yeah. On top of the 10 hours at work.
And a small child at home.
Yeah. And overnights and overtime. And so like the hours, as they say, the maths didn't math.
No. It's extraordinary because there's a shortage of staff.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And when you're offering to, I would have thought someone offering to work part-time there, they'd take the hand off you.
I would have thought so too, but ni mar a heater a beater, as we say in Connemara.
Translate for us.
It's not what you think is what's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah, I suppose it's the way to put it, yeah.
It's a real counter to what's for you won't pass you by.
Yeah.
Because it seems like this is not... this
might not be for me at all.
It's not for a young woman who's just had a baby.
No. And they will counter, you know, various training schemes. You know, the thing is, medicine and medical training has not moved with the times. Like, for example, the whole GAMSAT experience, those of us graduate entry, we're all older because we've done a degree. Most of us have worked a few years. So back in the day, people came in fresh off the boats, off the leaving cert. They were 22, 23 years old. They're not thinking of marriage and babies. And if they were, it was usually men. And they had a wife at home who looked after the homestead. That's not the way it is anymore. Mm. But the training definitely hasn't evolved with that.
So you realised this was your dream. You actually would have been a great asset to the health service. So, but you can't do it.
Not for the moment. I mean, I may come back to it in a few years' time when the baby's a bit older. But right now, it's just I can't do those hours. I don't want to do those hours. And I don't want to have to choose between a career and actually seeing my family. And I suppose the really sad thing is when I actually put this up on Instagram for the first time and spoke about it, I had an avalanche of messages from other women in the same position who've made the same choice. They've either backed away from training, they've quit training schemes, or they've ploughed their way through it. They've somehow managed to make it work. They've probably gone grey in age prematurely. And at the end have felt, was it really worth it? And nobody's been able to tell me it has been. And they carry the guilt with them. Now, maybe that's mom guilt. Maybe men don't carry this guilt. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it just was very sad.
How much did you spend on all this training and education to get to this point?
Ooh, a lot of money. The degree was roughly, the fees were €17,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're looking at the guts of 80 grand.
Yeah. In a pandemic when I used to work on evenings and weekends in sports and sports broadcasting.
Yes.
So all of a sudden my revenue stream kind of dried up as well. So it was a lean time. But look, we got through it, thankfully.
So you have borrowings still?
I do have borrowings. Good old credit union. Can't beat them.
Fair play to them. At least some bit of the system in the country is working.
They did. And to be fair, RCSI supported me as well. They were very good.
Just to give the context of what you're facing into, what is the day in the life of a trainee GP in hospitals in Ireland?
Depending on where you're placed, your day usually starts, say, if you're not on call, your day will start either at 8 or 9 a.m. You tend to round to the consultant, you see the new patients, and then you look after them during the day. And then if you're lucky, you might clock off at 5 or 6. Mm. If you're on call shifts tend to be 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. You're carrying the on-call bleep. Often you're carrying, so that's getting all the phone calls of all the other sick patients in the hospital, the arrest bleep, the stroke bleep. And if you're on call at night, you might be doing it 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. And there are some jobs, based depending on which hospital you're in, some people might show up on Friday morning for work and they mightn't leave again if they're lucky till Saturday afternoon. Some people might still be in the hospital Monday morning.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
I didn't even know some of the system because obviously we know the consultants, they wander around the hospital. Mm. They're the kind of misters or whatever you call them.
Yeah.
Then you have the junior doctors, your trainee consultants essentially.
Some of them, yes.
The reference to that.
Yeah.
And then you have the trainee GPs.
Yeah.
But we don't have full GPs. Do you work in hospitals?
No. They're safely ensconced in the community.
What can a trainee GP do, for instance?
A trainee GP, you wouldn't know if you're in a hospital. Like, for example, a lot of the doctors that you see you first, if you have the misfortune of ending up in ED, is often a trainee GP.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And they'll be the ones to first look after you, and then they'll be the ones then to start your management plan. And then if they have to, they might have to elevate up the system depending on how sick you are. So, like, we don't tend to open up the curtain and say, "Howie Oliver, I'm the trainee GP." You just say, look, I'm one of the doctors here and we go through it. So you do that for 2 years and then you go out into the community and you start working in surgeries. And then you're also getting teaching on the side. There's usually an afternoon or a half day put aside one day a week for your teaching. So you get to go there and you're learning more medicine and also more exams.
People are screaming out, fill the emergency departments with trainee GPs. You know how long you've been in education at that point.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of people as well who aren't on training schemes. They're just doctors like me who have their degree, who've done their internship. They're allowed, qualified, so to speak, to work in a hospital, but they're not on a training pathway. So you can work at that level as well and you can do some more exams to build you up, but you're not going to become a consultant in a thing, if you know what I mean, or you're not going to become a specialist anything, you're not going to become a GP. And some people are very happy with that as well. They're happy, you know, for example, you could potentially work through a recruitment agency and you're able to say, look, I'll work 2 days a week, or it helps facilitate childcare for a lot of people that way, or they might get in touch with various hospital HRs and say, I'm available if you're stuck. And that's a good way as well to keep your skills up and to work 1, 2, 5 days a week, whatever suits that person.
This is obviously a very serious problem that's happening in our midst. The nurses are really good at coming together as a union and fighting for what they can get. Sometimes win, sometimes they don't, but they certainly seem to mobilise. We don't hear of trainee GPs coming together. What's going on there? Do you ever talk to your colleagues and so on?
Or trainee doctors. And it's something I've noticed from day one. It's something I noticed even before I went into healthcare, because you know when the nurses are having a problem, and they're dead right. It's the exact right way to go about it. Doctors aren't as vocal. I think part of the reason is they're so exhausted, they haven't got the time.
Right.
You're changing jobs every 4 to 6 months. And like I just said, you could potentially go from Cork to Letterkenny. Okay. So your little support network that you've built up and you've complained with each other for 6 months, then you're sent somewhere new.
You're not hanging out together.
Yeah.
And you don't have time to have meetings about it.
Exactly. And you also have the issue, and be it true or not, there's definitely a perception there that if you do speak up, there could be potential repercussions and you could be known as that troublemaker, and then you wouldn't know.
What would happen to them?
Well, there just seems to be a fear that their progression could be stalled, or they could end up potentially not being supported to get to where they want to go. Be that real or not, or is it just a perception they have?
Okay, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So the GP system, you would have had to do those 2 years in the hospital, 2 hours away, 4 hour commute.
A year before I was going to find out where the next location was.
Okay, then, and then you move again, and then you still have 2 more years in a GP clinic before you become a full GP.
Yeah.
It's a very, very long road.
Yeah, but you know what? It's the right road, because at the very, when you think about it, a GP's out there by themselves. They've no access to imaging. They've no access to diagnostics. They're rowing their own canoe, and they have to decide. They have 7 or 8 minutes per patient, and you come in and they're trying to decide, is this a migraine? Is this a stroke? Is this a brain tumour? With no imaging.
Yeah, so, and that's for the patient who can get into the GP clinic.
Exactly.
So many of them are closed to new patients.
Yeah.
Waiting lists are enormous. You're in Carrickmacross, aren't you?
I'm living there at the moment, yes.
I know a lot about the problems there. Even there's a lovely, shiny new building recently built, but there are only certain days you can book appointments and so
on. Yeah, they're overwhelmed. And
they would love to have you.
Well, they're stuck. They probably would, yeah. But yeah, and it's a shame, because there's a growing population all over the country. But you just mentioned Carrickmacross. I think, you know, there's a vibrant population. There are lots of people moving into the region. It's a great place to live. So, but the services aren't keeping up with population growth. And it kind of does make me mad. Like, for the last few months, I've been watching people protesting outside, you know, hotels and things like this about, you know, giving beds to people less unfortunate and crying about services. And you're thinking, where have you been the last few years? Like, the GPs haven't just disappeared overnight. It's been like this for the last 10, 15 years. And you're protesting at the wrong place. You should be at the Department of Health.
Totally misdirected anger.
Yeah, exactly. And
blaming,
I understand why people
for
are angry.
Bad public services is not.
Which like have been bad for years. Yeah. And you see poor GPs taking the brunt of it as well around the country. Like, I've seen it. I've been on GP placement, and the conversation usually begins when the patient finally comes in. I spent ages trying to get this appointment and I couldn't get through. And the poor GPs, they're going grey, hair is falling out, saying, yes, let's get to the point here, because I need to really try and help you here. And it wears on them as well. It's hard for their well-being as well.
You're so right, because those protests outside those places have managed to change policy dramatically in government when it comes to immigration. Mm-hmm. And if those protests have been outside GP clinics by people in local areas, it would have affected things. It still
you
can.
Would imagine. I just think last year, remember Dublin Airport, when there was chaos, when the pandemic, when everything finally reopened up, and within a few weeks the airport, they'd managed to find extra staff and the queues had cut down and this kind of stuff. We don't seem to do for public services in this country. Housing and health are the two main ones, I think. I think everyone needs to speak up, as in I think the whole system as a whole needs to speak up, because there's been a culture for too long of healthcare professionals, I think, accepting it. And I think part of that is because we genuinely do want to help people. And I suppose I should say, out of all of this, I loved working in medicine. It's great fun. It's so much fun. I actually surprise myself by how much fun there is working in healthcare. It really is. But with that comes a side of potential guilt, and you're also trying to help people all the time. And if you're campaigning outside the hospital, you're not helping people inside the hospital. That's definitely a perception. So I think that's one thing. But I also think the government needs to cop on a bit and look at the things that can be fixed very, very simply. Like, for example, I have to sit on a bin when I'm typing. It'd be a very easy win to go into every hospital in Ireland, sure, there's a chair for every doctor. Like, and the next simple thing would be to fix IT so that we're not losing hours doing very basic IT admin work. That would be ideal. If they did that alone, the working conditions would improve so much, there would be more time for breaks, and we might actually entice the people who've left to come back. Because if you ask people who've left what bothered them the most, it was the constant grind, the nowhere to sit, nowhere to rest, nowhere to eat, the IT. Like, the IT would break your heart.
I've heard that, and people probably aren't aware that since that cyber attack, which is just before the pandemic in 2020, things haven't been fixed since then, 4 years later. I know of one hospital where consultants share x-rays on iPads, their personal iPads, because they can't email within the same hospital.
Yeah, and you can't access your email on your phone, for example, but but somebody's screaming at you, send that email because we want to transfer this patient to Beaumont, for example, and you walk into a ward and there's three computers, there's 10 people crowded around the computers, one might not work, you're shuffling people out of the way, you're trying to find your password, you're trying to log in, you're trying to find paperwork. Like, there's nothing streamlined. That's very frustrating, and I think
it's
more
surely something that can be easily fixed if you just...
It's an easy win, and I'm sure there might be people working in IT saying, oh, that simpleton has no idea how difficult it is, and maybe it's true, but it's because I've worked in so many places and this country is such a hub of IT, like, nobody else seems to have this issue. So when I saw
we're the tech capital of Europe, we keep saying,
do you remember
everywhere
a few
except
weeks
the
ago,
hospital.
There was an announcement how everyone's going to have their own access to their own health data on their phone.
The app which the NHS has had for years upon years.
Yes.
So this app, you had a grim laugh when you saw
it. I did, because I was like thinking, who's going to upload this up there? How is it going to get up there? And also, why haven't we got it?
What are you working at now while you take a break from GP training?
I can locum in hospital, so that's the plan. I'm going to do a bit of time doing a little bit
you
of that.
You can locum
well.
In a hospital.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. And also aesthetic medicine, which has actually become really popular. And I know there are some doctors who look down on that because they see it as beautifying people.
But aesthetic medicine.
Yeah, which
that's
is basically Botox
term.
For the uninitiated, basically. But what it does do is give people like me, and it's often women who are doing it who have small children, I know what time I start, I know what time I finish. You're dealing with patients who want to be there. Nobody's sick. You know, it's the walking well who just might want a little bit of a lift. Sometimes it's actually because people have migraine or whatever, and this helps. That's a whole other story. But people
Botox
are happy.
Is for migraines. I
you
think
can use
Tourette's
it for migraine,
syndrome,
for sweats. You can use it for muscle spasms.
Excessive sweating, we should
say. You can use it for bladder control issues, gynecological issues. Oh, yeah, its uses of Botox are wide and varied. Muscular pain. Like, I know we just see it as the aesthetic stuff. There's actually a whole pile of stuff. Mm. And there's also more and more data coming through that when people look in the mirror and they don't feel they look as tired and stuff, it makes them feel better about themselves, which makes them better able to face into the daily grind and improves people's well-being in a roundabout way.
Do you ever tell people Botox is not for you? You're too young.
Yes, absolutely. You'd have to be. And, you know, you are a doctor at the end of the day and you have to be for the good of the patient. And you do have people looking for stuff that just isn't suitable for their face. You know, there's a bit of a culture. People come in, they say, see this guy's nose or see this guy's lips. I want these. And, you know, you can't. You know, it's not going to work. Angelina Jolie's lips aren't going to work on the average Irish girl or Irish man.
Some of them try, though.
They do, and it's not a good look. And I think we saw there was an RT Investigates programme a few months ago of the bad practices. And
oh,
you have
God,
to be, is anybody thinking about it? Just make sure you're going to see a doctor or a nurse or a dentist, a medical professional who knows what they're doing, for sure. Because there are some people out there who are neither of those things. And it is a medical procedure. The risk of infection, inflammation, all that kind of stuff, it's huge.
And
but
if
it's
you go
enjoyable.
To a doctor, somebody like you, still in the training, you're going to know what to do. They'll be able to come back to you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we'll manage, help them manage complications, and we know what to do if complications happen, and complications do happen.
Well, how much is a shot of Botox now? If I want to,
that is a good
if I want
question.
To stop my eyebrows going up.
If you're just working on your eyebrows, you'd be spending, I suppose, good. You wouldn't have much change out of €150. But that stuff is expensive. It's made in Westport. It's a teeny tiny little amount of it.
It is. It's a Mayo.
I know, typical Mayo. Huh? They manage to get their steak everywhere. But so it comes all from the Allergan factory in Westport, and a teeny tiny amount. It's hugely expensive. So I know some people think the doctor took €300 off me, but a lot of that money is going to Westport. And then the other chunk is going to my insurer.
Oh yeah. Oh, for goodness sake. Yeah. There are a lot of people with eyebrows. eyebrows halfway up their heads. What's going on up there? It looks ridiculous.
It depends. Maybe they had a facelift. Maybe it's nothing to do with Botox.
Oh, right. I never factored that in. I just assumed that's Botox.
Could have been a plastic surgeon. It could be sometimes bad Botox placement. And that's why, again, it's really important to go to a professional. So sometimes it depends where you put the Botox. The muscle will react in different ways, basically. So, yeah, you have to...
A botched job by someone.
Yeah, you have to be able to read anatomy. That's where it comes back to your medical training again, that you know where the muscles are in the face, you know how they react, you know where the arteries are, you know where the blood supply is, and you know where the nerves are. You don't want to be meddling with those things.
That makes sense. Because these are the really important questions.
These are what people actually want to know. Nobody cares about the suffering. They just want to know, how do I get my Botox and how do I know it's safe?
They don't want to know trainee GPs and the state of the hospitals. No, listen, thanks so much. It has been fascinating. I'm sorry that you are a loss to the health system for now. Hopefully something changes, or maybe you'll just have to wait and you'll have to start again and go through all that stress of sitting on bins and so on. But you see, you have the passion for it.
I do, and I do love it. And I'd hate for people to think, oh, she spent all that money and had a miserable time. I didn't. I actually really enjoyed my intern year, as an example. I had amazing consultants, and they're lovely people who to this day I will contact and message, and they've been so supportive of me. And I'd hate for people to think that medicine's a bad career. It isn't, but it is a bad career for you if you're trying to do other things as well, because it's all encompassing and they haven't changed the model. And it's a shame, because just north of the border in the NHS, most people get flexible training if they want it.
Is that right?
And that may be an option for me in future as well.
Just up the road.
Yeah. I'm exploring that, you know, because...
Because you're in Carrick.
I'm in Carrick. And I did want to be a GP. I still want to be a GP. I always thought I'd be the GP who might do Botox of a Friday. Yeah. You know, but look...
That's
we'll
okay.
See.
That's allowed, and you've explained why that is. Look, it's been really valuable chatting to you. Thanks a million for visiting us. Moira Thrasa-Nicalig. Hopefully Dr. Moira Thrasa in the near future. Thanks a million, and go well and be safe.
Kurvila Mahad.
Email oliver@rte.ie. This is the Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1 podcast. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we welcome Arthur Matthews to the studio. We're going to go to all sorts of places this morning. I was asked, are you in good form, Arthur?
I'm in quite good form.
Anytime I've
There's
seen
There's very
you.
Few people here in RTE.
Yeah, there are. Yes, yeah, yeah.
You're here.
Thank God. We do show up, though. We do... Some of the radio's moved.
Yes,
to
I was just
cars.
Told that. Yeah, yeah.
Why
yeah.
was the last time you were here? Was it a buzz of activity?
I can't remember. I think it was a John Murray show a few years ago.
Oh yeah.
But it's very quiet. It's very relaxing.
Is this now your happy place?
Yeah, I'm in my happy place. I like you.
It's a good start.
Actually, look, I have to say, I love impressionists. And
you do. For sure.
I really do love impressionists.
You've worked with quite a few of them.
Richard Cooper, I know Gary Cook, Steve Coogan, but like I used to love one of my favourite things is, you know, do you remember Bobby Davro?
I don't actually.
Bobby Davro, he was kind of big in the early 80s, but he did the fantastic Alex Higgins impression.
Oh, go away, that would have been a good one.
Yeah, so I've tried to find it on YouTube, but I can't find it.
Some things are lost.
I love impressions.
And Dermot Morgan, of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I was going around school saying, no, he's not just Father Ted, he's an amazing impressionist.
Exactly, yeah. So who did you like as impressionists?
It was Dermot Morgan, like, primarily.
Really?
Yeah,
okay,
and there was
yeah.
tapes of Scraps Out. I thought it was kind of like of the moment in the mid-90s, but it was already long gone at that stage. I think it's only
I sent in a few scripts to Dermot.
Did you?
For that,
Into Scrap Saturday?
Yeah, I used to have an office in Ringsend, and I remember going there and dropping in scripts through the door. I think he might have used one of them. His Jimmy McGee was fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think the sketch I wrote was Jimmy McGee, but I don't think he used it.
Oh, was it Jimmy McGee? Because he was kind of filthy and he would just name all these players and eventually just...
I can't remember. Yeah, it was just brilliant. But I'm a huge fan of someone who does a really good impression. So you're very good.
I can't remember even off the top of my head what his... He had a catchphrase for... He had a kind of an in for Jimmy McGee, didn't he? Will I tell you?
That's good.
I remember.
Who's your favourite one to do?
Oh, geez, it changes from day to day. Well, because I've only started doing Keir Starmer, then it becomes your favourite straight away once you unlock the nose.
Yeah.
I suppose we'll have to. Impressions have to do the British Prime Minister.
Yeah, absolutely.
Joe Biden's very low energy.
Very low energy.
Low slurring is, I like the voice.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Where am I? There's no other way to do it, unfortunately. I
used to love Dana Carvey's Johnny Carson. Did you ever see Dana Carvey do that? No. Johnny Carson. It was brilliant. Anyway, Sam, I'm going back.
Unfortunately, Jack Nicholson's Johnny Carson has lasted longer in The Shining.
Yes.
Come here, we went to places already we didn't expect to go. You are our visiting critic, Arthur Matthews. Thank you for this. It was hard to find something outside your comfort zone. What is your comfort zone, first of all?
That's a very good question. I do. I do kind of jigsaws. That's very comforting.
Are you in prison?
Yeah, kind of in prison, but and I watch television and I listen to music a lot. I've got a man shed type thing, you know, that type of thing. We listen to a lot of music there.
Is that because you're not allowed to listen to your music in the house?
I'm not allowed.
Okay.
In the house.
How bad
I'm not allowed in the house.
How bad is the music? What's the music you listen to?
A lot of soul music, a bit of jazz, but everything. Like punk, some of my old punk records. I don't listen to a lot of that. I met this guy in London called Eddie Pillar, who's a soul DJ and a kind of king of the mods in London. I met him through Matt Berry because I work with Matt Berry.
Yeah, Toast of London.
Toast of London. And Eddie's amazing. And he's on radio station called Totally Wired Radio. So I listen to shows on that. And he does a modcast every year in Mallorca, which I'm going to.
Are you? Oh, yeah, do you interact month. With humans?
Yeah, I do. I will. Other people. I like other. I'm a people person.
Okay. I think you were kind of telling us, though, that you don't go out of the house too often.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't. I have in the past.
I don't like it.
I don't need to do that anymore.
I read somewhere that you're a huge Drogheda United fan.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you still go to the matches?
I do, yeah. I go about 10, 15 times a season.
15 times a season? That's pretty dedicated.
Yeah, but I live in Dublin, so I go to most of the Dublin games. But they lost last night. And you can watch all the games online. But they lost last night, which I watched. So they're now bottom of the league. So you're talking to me at a particularly low time. Yeah, you got me a bad time.
There's no League of Ireland's action this weekend, so it'd be grand.
No, but I'll be tuning into the Euros now for the next 2 weeks.
That's going to be good, isn't it?
Well, I watch all those games.
We'll be Scotland. We have to be Scotland fans. Is that the rule?
I don't think there is a rule. I think I'll back Albania, maybe.
Yeah, can't believe Albania there. We're not.
Well, that's the sad case. That's true.
It is true. So we're getting an idea of your various comfort zones. So we sent you out to play pickleball.
Yeah.
Who did you go with to play pickleball?
I went with my twin sister.
Oh, you have a twin sister?
Yeah.
Okay, we're finding out things about you already.
Yeah.
And how did that go? Where did you do it?
We went to Loughlinstown.
Yeah.
I'd never been to Loughlinstown.
Is that the big Westwood thing, is it? Or there's lots of sport down there.
It's a huge leisure centre place.
Okay.
So we arrived and Howard and Patricia, who are two Venezuelan pickleball players.
Go away.
They put us through our pace. It's like tennis.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like table tennis. Like the bats are like table tennis bats.
Yep.
And the ball is a kind of hollow ball.
Yeah.
Maybe it's more accurately called a sphere. So you can, you know, you just, it's like simple tennis. The net's quite low. So if you get over the net, you feel exhilaration and pride. And if it hits the net, it's, you know, self-loathing, despair.
It's Drogheda United, bottom of the league.
It's Drogheda United, bottom of the league. But no, it's great fun. Well, sorry?
Four players.
It can be two or
okay.
Four. We played doubles with my sister, Ria, played with Patricia and Howard.
Now, people are mad for this at the minute.
Yeah, it's really good. I think it might overtake real tennis within a few years.
Is it faster?
Not when I played it, no. You're supposed to go up to the net.
Yeah.
And just whack the ball back. That's it. There are rules.
It's a small wee court, isn't it, as well? So
I think it's more or less the same size as a tennis court, but the net is smaller and the bats are slightly different.
Is it really loud and annoying sound?
Yeah. In fact, I read that in America. It's big in America.
Massive.
And people complain about the noise of it.
Suing each other like crazy.
Yeah.
Suing pickleball. Because it takes smaller spaces, I think, in America,
it's kind of growing. It's big in America.
Yeah. And it obviously goes into working class areas because when you need smaller spaces, that's the sport they tend to play.
Yeah.
Golf is the opposite. It might drown out the sound of the grunting, which has irritated people in tennis, though.
No, there's no grunting in this.
No grunting at all.
No, I've never come across a pickleball grunting.
Has ruined tennis.
Yeah, it's destroyed, obviously. But I think, pickleball is going to overtake tennis.
Okay.
So tennis, within a few years, will be gone.
This sounds like a good review of pickleball.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll maybe back. I may build a pickleball alley in my own house.
And Carlos Alcaraz will be winner of the first Loughlinstown Open pickleball. It's Dunleary Rathdown Leisure Centre in Loughlinstown. That's where you play your pickleball.
Yeah.
And there are loads of courts all around the country. You can find them if you go to pickleballireland.org.
Yeah.
So it's happening here.
Yeah.
What else can you tell? How long is the game? Or how do you win? Anything else at all, Arthur?
You win by scoring more points than your opponent.
That's a come up for the books.
Yeah. I was concentrating getting the ball over the net. And Howard would position me in various places to receive a serve or to serve.
Very good.
And he was keeping track of the score and I wasn't at all. But I just hit the ball over the net. But
Did you win?
Yeah, but I think I was playing with... I played with Patricia, then I played with Howard.
Yeah.
And to be honest, he wasn't trying that hard. He could have destroyed me and my sister. I mean, really, really gone to town on us. But he was very kind and he let us win.
I see. Will you ever play pickleball again?
Yeah, I'd like to, yeah. No, I thoroughly encourage people to play pickleball. It was a great experience.
What are the kind of... You don't have to kit out or anything, do you?
Well, you can, yeah. You could wear a frogman's outfit if you want or a suit of armour.
But it's brand new.
There was nothing on the wall saying...
Whites.
There was none of that. No, I think you have to wear special shoes. Not special shoes, but shoes that won't damage the court. That was the only directive I got.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. Not to damage the court.
I don't understand. But right. If you probably hobnail boots, spiked rubbers or whatever.
Leave your Snickers workwear at home.
Yeah. No, it's pretty loose arrangement. Like, you know. But I wasn't playing at a professional level.
But he's going to do it again. That's a good review. Come here to me. The other thing, which I found odd, that you don't do very often, apparently, is watch the news.
Yeah.
Specifically the news and television.
Yeah, no, I don't watch the news. I've seen it before. I've seen the news. I know what it is. You've seen it, presume.
Yeah, no, I've seen it, yeah.
So I decided to watch...
RT News, 6-1?
Yeah, it was the 6-1 news. Cause
how long ago is it since you've watched it, do you think?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure if I've ever watched the whole thing from beginning to end. I might have done it like 1980, mid-80s. I don't know, I can't remember. But to sit down and watch the whole thing was a...
People generally, you know, they'll do 20 minutes, dip in and out, back for the weather.
I presume that's...
It still gets an enormous audience, we should say.
Yes, absolutely, It's very slickly done.
And this week, so did you watch it?
I watched it on Wednesday.
On Wednesday, which was more election counting and...
Well, I presumed it would start off with the election count. It started off with the Aer Lingus strike.
Oh, right.
Which immediately thought, oh, God, because I've booked a few flights.
Well, you're going to see that Mod Festival.
Yeah, I am. I'm going to Mallorca for the Modcast Festival, yeah, in July. So that might, you know, I thought, God, I hope that's not...
As someone who wrote the most fantastic, who was part of that amazing satire on news journalism, Brass Eye.
Oh, yeah.
What's your view of the news, the state of television news in 2024 after watching?
I hated the news.
You hated
I hated the news.
You still hate the news.
I hate the news.
Well, what's wrong with it?
Well, it's all bad news.
Oh, okay.
It's well done.
Yeah.
The you know, it's slickly produced. And that was nearly all women presenting it.
It is, yeah.
And the editor, producer is a woman. So I thought maybe this is a woman's only news channel and that maybe there was a men's news on RT1 or something.
RT News Now. But then the menu. It's the red button.
Probably what they've done is they've just got loads of women in because then maybe the news will be better.
I think softer edges, is that what you're thinking?
Something like that, yeah. I think the opposite has happened. I think the news is worse now with women presenting it. Do you think that?
Do you think it's their fault?
I don't know.
Women are to blame for climate change. That's Matthews.
So yeah, no, but then we're on
all wars.
The elections then. I made a note of what was in it. Something about horses being turned into dog food or something.
Yes, this was a Primetime Investigate special. It's actually made the Telegraph today.
Did it?
About horse meat, horses being badly treated put down at the end of the food chain in Europe. Who would have thought Ireland would produce a meat meat industry scandal?
Who would have thought? So that was, so that was depressing. It was something about water purity. Again, that was a big turn off.
I presume it wasn't good, was it? The water purity.
No, they weren't celebrating how pure Irish water was. It was literally a turn off, like a tap. what else was on it? It was just then there was sports news review. That was bad.
Oh, that cheers everyone up. Isn't that what sport is designed in there to do too? Yeah.
No, that was the only good news on Ireland had lost to Portugal. That was bad. But there was some athletics thing. Ireland were doing well in the athletics.
Of course, we've had the best European athletics championships of all time.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the only bright piece of news. And
followed by
thing.
The weather, which again, bad news.
Well, I see the whole thing was over. I thought it was over at 7 or near 7. I think it was over 10 to 7.
Oh, yeah. What happens then? I couldn't tell you.
Well, I don't know. I couldn't wait to turn it off, to be honest.
So you did the entire 50 minutes. Fair play.
I did, yeah. Well, that was the brief. You know,
I'm really sorry we put you through this.
I volunteered to look at the news and then turned off halfway through because I couldn't stand it. That would have been unprofessional.
Pickleball, good.
Yeah. But then maybe this was the weather after the news?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, I didn't stay for the weather.
All right. Oh, that's what you missed. Okay.
And then I missed the weather, I stuck with the rest of it. Can't fault the presentation or the professionalism of it.
Okay.
But it was just, it was a grim experience.
Very good. You just rescued the newsroom there. Okay, so that's a review. Pickleball, good.
Thumbs up, pickleball, thumbs down, the news.
Pickleballireland.org. Arthur Matthews is the unlikely poster man.
I'm the face of international pickleball.
We've done loads of your career. I mentioned at the start of the programme, so you're not getting another run of it. What are you up to these days?
Well, I've written a book,
yes,
which I see you have in front of you.
I have. About that, yeah. Did Father Ted make you comfortably off?
Mentally or...
Did it make you rich? Like Ricky, the office made Ricky Gervais a millionaire. Now you got to make it around the world. Well, I often wondered about that. It's such a huge show that we endlessly talk about.
I might get, as I said, I might get my own pickleball court. I still get royalty checks from it.
That's like old television, isn't it?
It's legacy television, I think it's called now.
Would it keep you going? Like, I'm not going to ask you how much it is, but
not just Father. I tell you what I made money out of was Ikeno,
musical. Okay, yeah. But it hasn't been on stage in years.
No, I know, but at the time, because a lot of people went to see that. Did something for...
It'd be worth staging again, by the way.
Well, they did revive it a few years ago, which was a very good production.
Yeah.
But I suppose it was of its time.
Did that make you more than anything else you've done?
Oh, I don't know. It's a good question.
The accounts are not in the shed where
I don't have the actual figures in front of me. But I did it. We did it because I work with Matt Berry a bit.
Yeah. And that's quite recent, isn't it?
Yeah. Within the last, we did the show called Toast, which I think we did in 2012, 2013. Mm. But like Matt's big in America and he does this show called What We Do in the Shadows. So he's like Disney Plus. So Disney Plus commissioned a script for us to write.
That's what you do now?
Well, we wrote the script.
Oh, it's okay. It's written.
And but then they... they have a few quid, Disney Plus.
You get paid once, don't you? You don't get the royalties.
Yeah, but then they passed on the script. And then they paid us for doing it. Then they passed on the script. So the script is still out there.
Oh,
and Matt thinks someone else might make it.
So you might get paid by all the streamers and it'll never be made.
Yeah.
That could potentially happen.
Yeah, yeah. No, they commission scripts and make shows. And as Matt told me that they made something with Meryl Streep, I think, that they haven't even broadcast.
Wow.
You know,
that's how much money they have.
They have a lot of money.
Multinationals saving the world.
Lots of dollars.
Let's talk about the book, Walled In by Hate. I didn't have to read it, you see, because we're talking about some other stuff, but I read it. It's fascinating. It's an unbelievable story. You kind of explain why you like the story in the prologue, don't you? Which is quite simple.
I do, yeah. Well, I read the book about O'Higgins about 30 years ago. It was originally written in the 40s. Was republished in the 80s. So Higgins was minister for Home Affairs, Minister for Justice at the time of the Civil War. Very violent time. And he was asked to agree to his, the man, Roy O'Connor, who'd been best man at his wedding. So he
A year before.
And then some deputies were shot outside the Dáil, and then Richard Mulcahy, I think he was Minister for Defence, suggested that they take some prisoners out who'd been captured in the forecourts in June as a deterrent. So one of them was Roy O'Connor, who was suggested. So there was a cabinet meeting and O'Higgins had to agree to this. And then, like, he was in Leinster House, so the executions were the next morning. So he would have been aware of that. And then he had to go into the Dáil to defend the executions. And then he, his own father was shot then, and he was assassinated.
Just a few months later.
Yeah, his father was shot in March 1923, and O'Higgins himself was 35 when he was shot.
Yeah, even though he looks like an old fella.
I know, yeah, yeah, he did. And and the time of O'Connor's death, he was like 30, you know, Minister for Justice. When I think what I was doing when I was 30, you know, trying to evade any kind of responsibility. And O'Higgins was like...
30 years of age, signing all these execution warrants.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think he actually... I think he didn't actually physically sign them. He just wanted the Civil War to end very quickly, so he became quite a proponent of that policy.
It worked.
Well, it did work, yeah. I think it was short, sharp shock, as to say. But I think De Valera admitted, that if the Civil War still would have been going on in the 30s if they hadn't done that.
You seem to point out that it's amazing that Richard Mulcahy, he's kind of the chief proponent, isn't he, of all these executions. And yet we don't consider him as a hate figure. Hardly consider him at all, to be honest.
Yeah, he's pretty low-key.
Yeah.
But they were tough people, you know, really tough people. Mm. And Cosgrove as well. Because Roy O'Connor and the other Republicans like Liam Lynch, Ernie O'Malley thought that they'd be easily scared out, which is a phrase he used. Like after Collins died, he thought they'd scare out the Free State. But they didn't. I mean, unluckily for them, a lot of the Free State hard men were Collins' old assassination squad. So, like, it was kind of Revenge of the Nerds, in a way.
Yeah, okay.
But it was a very violent time, yeah.
The anti-treaty regulars actually kill far more pro-treaty people than the other way around.
Yeah, I saw that recently. Figure recently, yeah.
UCC research.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Whereas
in
our memories, it seems to have been... Is it because of the executions, do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
We attach heroics really to the guerrillas because of the War of Independence.
Absolutely.
We're going around randomly shooting people. Whereas when you arrest people, they're in prison, you don't have a trial, and you shoot them against the wall, it has more echoes of the British treatment.
Plus, I think
is that why we...
But also, we just prefer rebels in this country to, you know, pragmatists. It's like, you know, what you could call the Shane McGowan effect. Like Shane's, it was like a state funeral when Shane died.
A state funeral / dance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he...
lovely.
I mean, Shane, he's probably not a great role model for people, really, but it was like, you know, absolutely heroic. I mean, I don't dislike Shane at all, but I think he was a big Father Ted fan.
I'm amazed by the day of Kevin O'Higgins' murder, 1927.
Yeah.
Cross Avenue, Booterstown, very well-to-do place then as it is now.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable death, isn't it?
Well, he was, he was going to Mass in a nearby church on Cross Avenue, where actually De Valera subsequently lived. So, but he'd usually have his bodyguard with him, but he sent his bodyguard off to buy cigarettes. So he's just walking towards the church and three anti-treaty IRA men just happened to be driving past. I think it seems to be a coincidence that they'd stolen the car. They were going down to Wicklow to a GAA match and they happened to have they were well armed, so they saw Higgins. They thought, is that him? And then they drove on and thought, no, it couldn't have been him. And then they thought, oh no, I think it was. So they went back to see him again. And then it was him. So they just stopped the car and got out and shot him. Three of them shot him. They put 7 bullets into him, I think. And they were kind of Colin's squad, and Colin's always said, make sure when you shoot someone that they're dead. But the O'Higgins was still alive, so he was talking to them and said, like, the killing has to stop. I know why you've done this, but I forgive you, but the killing has to stop. So they, of the three who shot him, I mean, they just got back into the car and drove off. But of the three who shot him, one was shot himself the following year. One never regretted shooting him. And the other, Bill Gannon, was really traumatised by it, especially the fact that O'Higgins had talked to him. So,
and we only know about what happened that day real from his confession to his son.
Yeah, years later, he told his son what happened, because no one was ever sent to prison for that.
No.
So it's just incredibly dramatic. And
but he's brought back into his house, Kevin O'Higgins. He's been shot seven times. He lives for much of the rest of the day.
Yes, he did. And lots of his friends and colleagues from the government went to see him.
They come in and out of the house. It's just, for a screenwriter, that's just unbelievable, isn't it?
It's incredible, yeah. It's really like hard to believe. And his private secretary was called Harry Kelly. And Harry Kelly's son was Henry Kelly from Game for Laugh, etc.
Going for gold.
And I remember him, he was an Irish Times columnist before all his TV career.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Una, Kevin's daughter, who's a remarkable woman, spent her whole life trying to wound the heels of the Civil War, and she founded the Glen Cree Reconciliation Centre. So she's a remarkable woman. So she's probably the hero of the story, really. And then that, as well as all the violence, he had Hazel Lavery, Lady Lavery, an obsession with her, and she seemed to be kind of obsessed with him as well. So that's kind of love triangle as well.
Yeah, I love the little bits that kind of when you read books like this, you get snapshots of things you've forgotten or didn't hadn't learned before. Republican women in the Dáil had a collective nickname, brilliant one.
Oh, what was that?
It's pretty sexist. The Furies.
The Furies, that's right. Yeah, yeah. They're also known as the Women and Childers Party.
Women and Childers.
After Erskine Childers, who O'Higgins had a great dislike of.
You point out that as we're kind of looking back at history, we've sort of, you know, lionised the female members of the Dáil, obviously in the kind of feminist wave, but they're pretty violent.
I read Padraig Yates' book about the Civil War in Dublin, and Countess Markovitch, Constance Markovitch, was in charge of some Republican snipers in O'Connell Street or somewhere, and they were shooting at the Free Staters across the street in the windows. And she said, don't aim at them, aim at the window frames, because the splinters will go into their eyes and blind them.
Jeez. Wow.
So they were pretty tough, as I say, they were tough people.
They were as bad as the men in some ways.
As Which brings us back to the female newsreaders.
Who are to blame for all wars. Do you like Kevin O'Higgins?
It's so difficult. I think he was incredibly brave. I mean, walled in by hate is a phrase he used about himself, because he was so hated and he probably knew he'd be killed. It was so different from me, like, you know, as a person. I think he was very brave. I think he did what he thought was right. I think that this country was in a state of anarchy, so the Free State government felt they had to really use drastic methods to sort it out.
And of course, I'd like to have
met him. My grandfather was in the Dáil as a result of O'Higgins' assassination. Also Arthur Matthews. So there was a general election. He was elected as a result of the assassination. I wonder if he may have met O'Higgins. I don't know. But Collins and O'Higgins and all these people. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to have met them.
It's a great book. Historians, they do a good job on stories like that, but when you've got a writer from other areas, I think it makes it much more
exciting and appealing. I mean, it's a very serious topic. I've tried to lighten it up.
No, it's fantastic. It's called Walled In by Hate, by the way, and it's by Arthur Matthews. We're going to have to take a break. 51551. We'll be back after these.
Email Oliver at rte.ie.
There's a message in here from Sinead Holland from Laois Local Studies who says, can you mention that Arthur Matthews is talking in Port Laois Library on the 24th of July on this new book on Kevin O'Higgins? That's obviously the O'Higgins territory, Arthur, isn't it? Stradbally, was that the home?
Yeah.
Stradbally's home. Or Port Leisha, as you're supposed to say. Port Leisha. Now, I said at the start I'm going to mention sport. And since you're into football and all that, we might as well mention no Irish involvement in the Euros. So we're going to have to back Scotland and our fellow Celts, of course, who are in action tonight in the opening game against Germany. Germany, by the way, they looked like they were obviously going to crash out here because they got through by hosting without qualification.
Oh, yeah.
And losing to Austria and famously lost to Japan. But apparently they're back in action. I was reading in the Guardian previews at the weekend.
Okay.
So they're one of the favourites now.
I think
again.
They're lacking top quality strikers.
Spoken like a true pundit.
Which I read that somewhere.
Yeah, that's a lot of puffballs of the team. Have you heard the unofficial Scottish anthem?
No.
Where is it called? Oh, it's Nathan Evans. He's a fellow who's gone viral on TikTok and he's written this song and he's kind of proponent. I'll play a bit of it here, right, to get us all vavavoomed up. There's a place I know. It's terrible enough to make it, isn't it?
You're not going
to
win it with that. I remember, Ali's Army in 1978.
Ali's Army?
Yeah, we're on the march to Ali's Army. We're all going to Argentine. Never, they didn't do very well.
They didn't win. But apparently there are more Scots in Munich than in any city outside of Edinburgh and Glasgow right now because they are so excited, because they were expected to get through the group for the first time in the history of all their time trying. Americans are buying up more of the tickets than any other nationality, even more than the Germans. So that's to do with the spending power because of probably Joe Biden's boom or whatever. Other stuff happening this weekend. Well, England are going to play Serbia. That's the choice match that people are watching as well. That's 8 o'clock on Sunday. And no League of Ireland, as I said, in the GAA. Do you watch any of that at all, Arthur?
Not much, no.
Oh, you really frowned there during that one. Pick of the action, Cork, Tyrone. This is the last of the round robin fixtures, the acres of matches that'll take to knock out the four obvious teams. But anyway, Cork, Tyrone, that's on GAA Go, Saturday 3 p.m. What else is them? Oh, RT Television on Sunday. It's actually matches on free to air. Dublin Mayo is a pick of it. And of course, Armagh Galway will be before that as well. It's all live on RT One Television. Monaghan Meath, by the way, is live on GAA Go. The US Open as well. Happily married Rory McIlroy is going to be there in the latest major. He's expected to do well. And there's rugby as well. URC semi-finals, Leinster versus Bulls, live somehow on RT Player, that is, on RT Television as well. The GA basically is RT One, the GA Ask Gaelic and RT News Now. RT Two is showing the Euros and RT Radio One has sport from 2 o'clock until 9. There you go. So you know everything from the show. Don't wipe yourself with a tato bag. You're never going to think of your GP the same way again. And you're about to become a pickleball fan thanks to Arthur Matthews. So we always give you things to dwell upon into the weekend. It's the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you definitely think we should know, pop us an email anytime. It's always open. Oliver at rte.ie. Cheers, August Slaw.